Money FM 89.3, best of breakfast. Why it matters on Money FM 89.3.
You're listening to Money FM 89.3 with Adrian Abraham and Lin Li Fu. Time now for Why It Matters, and this topic is very interesting. India is poised to become the world's most populous country this year, surpassing China, which has held the distinction since at least 1950. This, of course, when the United Nations population records began. The UN expects that India will overtake China in April, although it may have already reached this milestone, since the UN estimates are projections.
So what will this mean for the rest of the world, and what are the possible benefits and drawbacks of India overtaking China as the most populous country in the world? Joining us on the line is Dr. Kanti Bajpai, Vice Dean, Research and Development, and Wilma, Professor of Asian Studies at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at NUS. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Kanti, first up, could it strengthen India's claim of getting a permanent seat in the UN Security Council? I mean, just five permanent members, including China. India, of course, is a founding member of the UN and always insisted that its claim to a permanent seat is just.
India definitely wants to be a permanent member. I don't think, though, that this is particularly going to strengthen that claim. The projection that India would pass China has been on the cards for a very long time. It hasn't particularly, you know, speeded up the decision-making in the UN on UN reforms, which would be needed to put India in as a permanent member. And, you know, that decision is very complicated. It rests on a lot of geopolitical issues, on economic issues. But most of all, there are so many other claimants. Japan wants to be in, Germany wants to be in, Brazil would like to be there. Those claims are strong as well. So the UN has to consider how many more it really wants to let into that elite club and the implications of that for decision making. So I don't think it's going to rest on the demographic issue.
According to Pew Research Center, one in five people below 25 years in the world is from India, and 47% of Indians are below the age of 25. Tell us about the significance behind these numbers.
Well, first of all, it's a projection, so nobody counts the exact number of people in both countries, that is India and China or anywhere else exactly. It'll happen in a few weeks if it hasn't happened already. India has long, I mean, at least for the last 20, 25 years, benefited from having a lot of young people and working age people, that is people between the age of about 25 and 60. Whereas China's numbers are going down, for instance, and in most of the developed world, they're going down. Most of East Asia, they're on a decline. So India, in that sense, you know, has a huge potential pool of people for the workforce, both skilled and not so skilled.
Yeah, it is. We're talking about the largest pool of global talent heading into the future. Moving away from just that, how has India's demographic changed compared to China's population? I mean, this is quite fascinating to look at.
Well, as I said, you know, India has a lot more young people, and this is going to be the case for at least the next 30 years or so. What's interesting is that, you know, China increasingly has, as you said, an aging population, and that's, some people think that's going to be a drag on its economic growth and perhaps even for social stability as a result. India, looking ahead, is going to face kind of a dumbbells problem, which is, you know, it's going to have a lot of young people at one end and increasingly a huge pool also of elderly people, because with medical advances, with better health and education, Indians are going to live longer as well. So you're going to get a peculiar situation of a lot of young people who need employment and education to be productive, and a lot of elderly people retiring who will need to be supported as well at the same time. So I think that's kind of a difference. And people don't talk much about the looming elderly challenge in India, but it's coming.
Professor, what does this mean? What does population shift mean from an economic perspective and a global one at that?
Well, of course, first of all, I guess there's good news in the sense that a huge population which has consumer demand, wants goods and services, will help prop up India's economy for a long time. A lot of India's economy is run on the basis of internal demand. And of course, that means also increasingly external demand. So people will want to be a part of India's market as a result. But there are negatives. You know, the quality of your population matters for productivity, for instance. And there are big challenges ahead. India's literacy is running just over 70%. China's would be up at over 90%. then, you know, the issue of stunting. This is people who don't reach their proper height. The problem is not the height. It's the effect on your cognitive abilities. And about 35 to 40% of Indians are stunted. This is the highest figure in the world. I mean, the total number of stunted people in the world are in India, about 550 million. So you can imagine these people whose cognitive abilities may have been affected at a young age. How do they work in a modern world economy? So I think that's a very big challenge. And of course, India's record on health and education still leaves something to be desired. So the real question is, will this big demographic surge and dividend with a lot of young working people pay off, or will it turn into a nightmare in India?
Yeah, you learn something new every day. Wow, that is quite a figure there. Now let's talk about a pressing issue that has dominated news headlines over the last few years, COVID-19, and it had a huge impact on both these nations, India and China. China, of course, lifted its zero COVID policy in early 2023. Talk us through how these countries both not only adapted to this new post-COVID era, but also some of the challenges that they face and how they overcame them.
Yeah, the first thing I want to say is that it's very clear now that every country and society has dealt with COVID in different ways and have paid a price at different times, I think. India was somewhat more like the Western countries. It had an initial very bad surge of COVID, didn't handle it particularly well, was somewhat slow to vaccinate, and of course, you know, paid the price in terms of a lot of infections and deaths. China held off for a very long time, and in a sense is now going through India and Western countries experience. The difference being that the strains of COVID that hit India and the Western countries early were far more lethal, and we didn't know that much about how to combat them in hospitals and so on and so forth. China is, I think, benefiting with all the troubles it's facing right now in dealing with a strain that's not so lethal, and with, you know, a population that has been vaccinated far more than in the early years of COVID that India faced. So India paid a price early, but now it's virtually, I mean, the numbers, if government figures are to be believed, are in the 4,000 and 5,000 cases, whereas China is surging in the tens of thousands, perhaps. In India, if you go there in the cities and workplaces and so on, nobody's wearing a mask. Vaccination rates, even of the elderly, would probably be running over 80% and higher. There's no vaccine hesitancy in India. I think to some extent, amongst elderly Chinese and some segments of the Chinese population, there has been a kind of vaccine hesitancy as well, and their rates seem to be lower. So I think, you know, the two have had different experiences. Sadly, both have paid a price in terms of deaths and other medical problems in their population.
Let's talk about an important demographic of India's population, women. Women in the workforce in India, I'm sure there are a significant number of women who are leaders and managers. Which country, including India, do you think is better prepared to produce such top leaders and managers?
Yeah, that's an interesting and challenging question, actually. But I think both have strengths. Of course, China's literacy rates are higher for men and women. It's the entry of Chinese young people into universities is about double that of India. So, you know, if I had to place my bets, I would place my bets on China having a greater number of women in important positions. India, the one strength it does have here is it seems to have a record of placing, people in very high positions. We think of some of these well-known Indian CEOs of various companies, especially in the United States. And I think that arises from maybe a couple of things. One, India, because it's so diverse culturally, linguistically, Indians who are well-educated and in the workforce are very used to dealing with a great deal of cultural diversity. And I think that's probably important in a managerial setting. And the second is that, you know, a lot of talented Indians, men and women, have very good English language skills. They grew up with them in the big urban centers and so on. So I think worldwide, it doesn't matter where you are now, English language skills matter. And so I think those two things stand the Indians in good stead. And so they're, despite the other constraints vis-a-vis China, they seem to place people in very high positions. But on the whole, I think there would be a much greater representation of women in high positions in China. I don't have the figures, but that's a good guess.
Yeah, very interesting. Let's talk about you for a little bit as well. Your most recent book, India versus China, Why They Are Not Friends. Tell us a little bit about this book and what inspired you to write about this topic.
Well, what inspired me was a kick in the pants from my publisher in India. It was the summer of 2020. India and China had faced off in a military confrontation in Ladakh at a height of, 15,000 feet, and there were a few deaths on both sides. So it just seemed timely. There was a lot of stuff worldwide, and of course in India particularly, about why India-China relations had suddenly spiraled downwards after many years of, at least business-like interactions and trying to resolve conflicts and so on. So the book was written for the general readership. It's not a very academic book, although I would say it's rigorously argued. It was an attempt to try and tell ordinary Indians particularly what was going on with China and why it was the relationship so fraught. So that's the background to the book.
And just one more before we wrap this up. Where does net migration fit into this equation? There's an exodus of Indians moving abroad for a better life, and we can see this with China as well. So how does this all contribute to the population numbers as well?
Yeah, I don't think it makes a big difference to the demographic problem. I mean, the numbers of Chinese and Indian immigrants in absolute numbers look quite large in their host populations in Australia, especially in Western countries. But yeah, I mean, given the growth rates at home and the very large numbers at home, the numbers are not all that significant. And I think over time, both are aware that they are losing talent. I think China has done a better job of bringing talent back because it's economically surged. And so young Chinese have had an interest in coming back to China for jobs and so on. But I think on the whole, both countries have decided, and both governments, that it's better to let these talented people go abroad, work there, reside there, let their talents bloom and be put to good use, rather than have them, back home, perhaps unemployed or underemployed and restless and restive and unhappy. And I remember many, many years ago, the late Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi said, better that we should have a brain drain than a brain going down the drain. And so I think that's the kind of philosophy both have. It's a loss, but, you don't want unhappy, underutilized people sitting at home because your economy can't absorb them.
All right. Thank you very much for sharing your perspectives with us this morning. We've been speaking to Dr. Kanti Bajpai, Vice Dean, Research and Development, and Wilma, Professor of Asian Studies at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, National University of Singapore. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.